Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to the virtual 2021 Evidence-Based Policing Conference. My name is Sasha Hatchett. I am the Assistant Chief Constable in North Wales Police, and I am the Welsh Police Force Lead for Evidence-Based Policing. I'm delighted to be facilitating my second webinar of the series, and I have the pleasure of introducing today's exciting and topical webinar titled First, Let's Stop the Bleeding, Urban Violence and What to Do About It. It is my great pleasure to introduce Thomas Abt, a senior fellow with the Council of Criminal Justice in Washington, D.C., where he directs the National Commission on COVID-19 and Criminal Justice, hugely topical as we continue to police serious organised crime in a pandemic. Thomas has an impressive CV, previously served as a senior fellow at Harvard, as well as having held senior leadership positions in the New York Governor's Office and the U.S. Department for Justice. His TED talk on saving lives by stopping violence has reached over 170,000 views, and having watched it myself, I can understand why. He looks at an innovative and targeted strategy to make our city safer right now without big budgets and without new laws. Thomas is also the author of a book published in 2019, Bleeding Out, The Devastating Consequences of Urban Violence and a Bold New Plan for Peace in the Streets. Thomas, I have to admit, I am standing today. Alex Murray was supposed to facilitate this session, but unfortunately he's been called away, and he is a huge fan. I know he will be watching this on catch up, and I think you can expect a phone call afterwards. So before I hand over, I just wanted to outline how we anticipate that the session will run. So Thomas will present for about 35, 40 minutes, and then there will be a question and answer session at the end of the presentation. Please use the sidebar to ask your questions. And please, if you can, start the questions with a cue so that we can pick them out easily. And then at the end of the session, with the help of Suzanne, who is our backstage star and everything to do with IT, then we'll put them to Thomas. So without further ado, welcome everyone, and over to Thomas.
Well, thank you so much, Sasha. Thank you to Alex as well, the Society of Evidence-Based Policing, and everyone who is listening today. It's an absolute pleasure to be with you. So let's begin. All right, hopefully you can see my screen. I want to start out with a metaphor that I use in my TED talk and is actually at the beginning of the book as well, and that's the metaphor of an emergency room. And as I say in the book and in the talk, we should try to imagine ourselves as surgeons, working late at night on a weekend in an emergency room in a big city that suffers from high rates of violent crime. And imagine that a young man is wheeled into your emergency room and he's suffering from a gunshot wound. He's losing a lot of blood quickly. Now, you examine the wound and you see that action is needed. And so the question is, what do you do? Or maybe more importantly, what do you do first? The young man, his clothes seem somewhat ragged. He likely suffered a long series of deprivations. He may be homeless, jobless. He may lack an education. So perhaps that's the right place to start. Perhaps you should think about securing housing, tutoring, or some other services for this young man. On the other hand, the young man's been involved in some sort of conflict. He may be potentially dangerous. So maybe the first thing you do is restrain him or call security or even call the police. I think most of us listening to this seminar today wouldn't do any of those things. Instead, we would do the only thing that made common and moral sense. First, we would stop the bleeding, because unless we stop the bleeding, the young man would die. And really, that is the larger argument that I'm trying to make in Bleeding Out, in my TED talk and to you today, which is that we need to treat urban violence like a gunshot wound. We need to stop the bleeding. And so I'm going to proceed in this talk the way I have in the book, which is really addressing the issue of urban violence through the four stages that you would see commonly in an emergency room. We'll begin with triage, proceed to diagnosis, continue to treatment, and ultimately end with prognosis. So first, let's talk about triage. And triage is either on the battlefield or in the hospital, sort of the art and the science of putting first things first, of using scarce resources to save the most lives possible. So I want to talk about why we should prioritize urban violence. And apologies, much of my data is focused on the United States, but I can say that urban violence, context to context, city to city, country to country, looks quite similar. And so much of these observations hopefully will resonate wherever you are in the world. But focusing on the United States, which is where the book is centered, there were over 16,000 homicides in 2019, and I'll talk about 2020 last year towards the end of the talk. And every homicide is enormously costly. The leading estimates range from $10 to $19 million in total social costs, and that's the cost of the criminal justice system, the medical system, and every other cost, many of them intangible or indirect. And so that includes the costs of suppressed property values, increased insurance premiums, and other things associated, not just with the direct cost of fear and violence, but the indirect cost of all the fear and avoidance triggered by such violence. Now, most non-conflict homicides, homicides outside conflict zones, are associated with urban violence. That's in both in the United States and around the globe. And urban violence is, the term is an imperfect one, but it's really to describe the everyday lethal or potentially lethal violence that happens on the streets of our cities. Some call it in the US gun violence, gang violence, community violence. There's a street violence and other terms. And really, urban violence is the intersection of all of those things. Each of those terms describes a different aspect of it. Here in the United States, since September 11th, unfortunately, hundreds have died in domestic terrorist attacks and in mass shootings. But more than 100,000 have died due to urban violence. And urban violence is the primary driver of non-conflict death, violent deaths all around the world. Unfortunately, we do not bear this burden equally when it comes to urban violence. Homicide disproportionately impacts the poor and powerless in societies. In the United States here, black men account for less than 7% of the US population, but more than half of all gun homicide victims. And in 2019, unfortunately, violence was the leading cause of death among young black men and boys, and it caused more deaths than the 9 other leading causes combined. Now, urban violence traumatizes the poor, making every other aspect of social and economic development more difficult. It's harder to educate kids when they're traumatized by violence. It's harder to attract economic investment when violence scares people away. It's harder to reach all of your physical, mental, and emotional health outcomes that you want to. It's hard to have quality housing. All of these things are challenged when rates of violence are too high. But perhaps the most profound way that violence impacts the poor is the impact on children. We know from some pioneering studies here in the United States that all things being equal, children tend to perform better when they have less exposure to violence. And that's even controlling for income, poverty rates, other factors in terms of opportunity. If children are not exposed to violence either as victims or as witnesses, even when poor, they tend to do much better in terms of life outcomes. And in fact, Pat Sharkey, following up on this evidence, demonstrated that that converging evidence shows that exposure to violence may be the most important way that poor children are impacted negatively in terms of poverty. And that basically, exposure to violence may be the key factor that traps these children, unfortunately, in poverty. And so what I want to suggest to you is that many of us are familiar with the terrible cycle of violence where inequality, lack of opportunity, poverty all combine to create social dysfunction, including crime and violence, and that there is a causal mechanism between all of these structural factors or root causes and high rates of crime and violence. But I also want to suggest to you, and in fact argue that the evidence is quite strong on this, that the causal mechanism works in both directions, in that high rates of crime and violence are in fact responsible for perpetuating inequality, perpetuating poverty, perpetuating lack of opportunity. And so you need to be, we need to be aware that this this relationship runs in both directions. So having described why it's so important to address urban violence, let's talk about diagnosing it. Obviously, we can't treat an injury or an illness unless we understand it. So I want to begin with the empirical basis of the book, and that is the empirical basis is really is largely based on a systematic meta-review that was performed by myself and Chris Winship, former chair of the sociology department at Harvard, in 2016. And some of you may be familiar with this, but a meta-review is a review of reviews. And as you can see from the graphic, you start with by synthesizing studies through systematic reviews, systematically synthesizing the results of high-quality impact impact evaluations, and then you synthesize those reviews again. And this is a relatively rigorous, robust, and efficient way of getting one's arms around a tremendous amount of research. And in fact, in our case, we were able to synthesize the results of over 1,400 individual impact evaluations. But we didn't stop there. I went around the country interviewing people with firsthand experience with violence. You know, street cops, former gang members, former shooters, mothers who had lost children, faith-based leaders, other community leaders, all trying to really understand what people saw when they were witnessing and experiencing violence firsthand. And the interesting thing is what we learned from the academy and what we learned from the community was really quite similar. And it was reassuring to know that while they used very different language, they were ultimately describing the same phenomenon. So what did we learn? The first thing we learned is that urban violence is sticky, meaning that it concentrates among a surprisingly small number of people, places, and is associated with a few key behaviors. For instance, in New Orleans, half of all killings occur within the network of only 600 to 700 people. And in most cities, half of all murders involve less than 0.6% of the city's population. But this violence doesn't concentrate just demographically, it concentrates geographically. Here, right here in Boston, where I am, 70% of shootings over three decades concentrated in approximately 5% of all city blocks. And in most cities, about 4 to 5% of geography accounts for all of crime accounts for more than half of all crime. And serious violent crime, such as homicide, is even more concentrated than crime generally. And David Weisbord has gone, a criminologist here in the United States, has really gone so far to articulate that this evidence is so strong that it really should be viewed as a law, the law of crime concentration. And violence is also finally facilitated by a few hot key behaviors, such as illegal gun carrying, as well as gang and gun conflicts. So the science is saying violence is sticky. You need to focus on hot people, hot spots, and hot behaviors. And so that's ultimately our first fundamental principle of effective violence reduction. If you want to be successful, you must be focused. Now, it's not surprising that if urban violence is sticky, then sticky solutions seem to work best. And we see this in criminal justice and in the literature. It's true for policing, gang prevention, reentry, and other factors. The interventions that focus on the highest risk people, places, and behaviors tend to generate the strongest effects. This isn't just true in criminology and criminal justice. This is also true in public health, where targeted secondary and tertiary programs tend to outperform primary prevention ones. And so this is an important thing to understand. Now, some people would argue that, would worry that yes, crime might be concentrated amongst certain people in certain places, but then once you focus on it, the crime will be displaced, or that the people, if they change their lives or are incarcerated, will be replaced. But luckily, we have over 30 years of scientific research that says the opposite, and that crime relocates only in a minority of instances. Again, there is something sticky about this phenomenon. It takes a lifetime of trauma to generate a quote-unquote shooter, and it takes decades of disinvestment to create a quote-unquote hotspot. The second thing we learned, both from the literature and from people in the community, is that both quote-unquote tough and quote-unquote soft approaches are effective in reducing urban violence. This shouldn't be surprising. We all respond to both rewards and punishments, meaning incentives and disincentives. And so we saw in the literature that there were some quite effective enforcement-oriented approaches for reducing violent crime, but there were also some equally effective non-enforcement approaches, approaches that were quite prevention-oriented. And it's reasonable to assume that you need both. You need prevention to divert future offenders, and you need punishment to deter or remove current offenders. And so we need to combine the immediacy of both of these things with the sustainability, the immediacy of punishment with the sustainability of prevention. And in fact, to my knowledge, no American city has successfully used either one approach or the other. We've never successfully arrested our way out of violence, but we also haven't successfully just programmed our way out of violence. And my experience with cities internationally is quite similar. The third fundamental is that urban violence is closely connected to legitimacy. Less perceived fairness in policing and in criminal justice more generally leads to more violence. Now, how does that happen? There's a body of evidence around the concept of procedural justice that shows that lack of trust and confidence results in less compliance and more violence. If people don't believe that the process by which they are policed is fair, they don't respect that process and they don't comply with it. There's also another body of evidence associated with legal cynicism that suggests that when communities do not believe in the criminal justice system, they don't use it, meaning they withdraw from the system. And then what happens there is that they don't turn to the system for perhaps its most fundamental purpose, which is the nonviolent resolution of disputes. And so those disputes can turn violent and ultimately fatal. It's important to understand, based on the work of Justice Tankibi and others, that legitimacy is not simply a matter of fairness. It's not simply enough to be non-corrupt and non-brutal. You must also achieve the basic ends of the criminal justice system and policing, which is to keep people safe. So a system cannot be legitimate if it is simply fair. It has to be both fair and effective. And here in the United States, when you survey people who reside in dangerous areas, they have a double set of complaints. They complain that they are arrested too much, that they are prosecuted and incarcerated too much, and they believe deeply that they're being treated unfairly. But at the same time, they are deeply frustrated that the police are not doing more to protect them from the most serious forms of crime, such as shootings and killings. We'll discuss this a bit more later. So having diagnosed urban violence, let's proceed to treatment. And I'm going to focus here on some law enforcement strategies because we're in a law enforcement context and many of you are likely in law enforcement yourself. But I want to stress here that there are many non-law enforcement strategies that need to complement the law enforcement strategies as well. So what you need to do, and so if violence is concentrated among a small set of people, places, and behaviors, then you're going to need some people-based strategies, some place-based strategies, and some behavior-based strategies, all working at the same time to reduce violence. So what do people-based strategies in this area, the most successful ones, have in common? Crudely speaking, they all follow these five steps that I've shown here. First, they identify those who are most at risk for violence, the individuals and groups who are most at risk, and then they engage them directly. Once engaged, they stabilize these individuals by meeting their immediate needs, often associated with safety and security. Once they've stabilized them, they treat various forms of unhealthy thinking and unsafe behavior, often generated by trauma. Many people at the highest risk for violence would be characterized as hypervigilant. Based on all of the trauma that they've experienced, they are hypervigilant, meaning they are quick to see threats, they are quick to respond to them, often in an instant. And so we have to work on treating that hypervigilance. If you don't treat that hypervigilance, what we see is that most people will fail out of attempts to provide opportunities. And so you have to stabilize people and treat them before you can offer opportunities. And so once treated, and once this unhealthy thinking and unsafe behavior is addressed, then we can offer educational and employment opportunities. And unfortunately, this is not a perfect system. We must ultimately punish those who persist in violence with swift and certain sanctions. And I want to point out, as many of you are probably familiar, with punishment, it is more important to be swift and certain than it is to be severe. So I want to talk about the leading anti-violence strategy that is people-based, and that's called focused deterrence, also known as the group violence intervention, also known as ceasefire. There was a systematic review that was performed in 2018. It was actually a updated review of a previous review, and it identified 24 tests in total. None of these were randomized controlled trials, but they were all relatively rigorous quasi-experiments. Using the vote counting method, we know that 19 of the 24 successfully reduced crime. And in particular, for the focused deterrence efforts that were specifically focused on gang and group violence, they were successful 12 out of 12 times. And I want to note here that they had a very large effect size of 0.657. That is a very large effect size that's rarely seen in the criminal justice field. And that translates to reductions in shootings and killings of 40%, 50%, 60%, large, significant, and substantively significant declines. And why is focused deterrence successful? Well, it's because it's aligned with the anti-violence fundamentals that I've articulated already: focus, balance, and fairness. Focused deterrence focuses, as its name suggests, on the highest risk individuals and groups. It then engages those individuals, not just with policing, but also with community members and with service providers. And it presents these individuals with a choice. If you continue with your violence, we will bring you to justice. But if you stop engaging in violence, we will work with you. We will offer you services, assistance, and other forms of support. So it's balanced in that way. It's offering services and support, but also promising accountability. And then the fact that it's presenting these individuals and groups with a choice means that it's likely to be perceived as fair. Also, the fact that it's not just a police-led effort also means that it's likely to be perceived and that people are being warned in advance about what this partnership will do. All of these things lead to these efforts being perceived as fair and legitimate. So let's talk about place-based approaches. Here we need to use evidence and community-informed strategies that are focused, balanced, and fair to take the following three steps in micro-locations known as hotspots. And I just want to point out, we're not talking about large parts of the city. We're not talking about neighborhoods. We're talking about micro-locations, a specific housing project, a specific liquor store, a specific nightclub on a specific night. It's that level of concreteness and specificity. So what do you do in these micro-locations or hotspots? You need to institute problem-oriented policing in these locations. And I'll talk more about that in a moment. You need to direct law enforcement attention to these locations, but it can't just be law enforcement. You have to follow up with community-based, with investment and placemaking. And then you need to supplement both your policing and placemaking efforts with community building. And I don't mean community building in a sort of kumbaya, broader, let's all get along sense. What I mean is you need to have a micro community that can work together to address this concrete problem of violence. So that means not trying to reconcile all community members with all members of law enforcement. It means creating a micro community of a set of key residents in and around this micro location, a set of key officers from that key precinct or district, and a few key business leaders and others, all who can perform a micro community to work on this important issue. So let's talk about how this is done in terms of policing. There's been a number of systematic reviews in this area, and Braga performed a recent systematic review on hotspots policing with 78 tests, 10 of which were randomized controlled trials. And here we see that most of these strategies had a small but meaningful positive effect. And I want to note here the modest effect size of 0.132. What that means is that we can have a great deal of confidence that hotspots policing is effective in reducing crime. Unfortunately, we also know that it's not incredibly effective. It's only modestly effective. This is suggesting that if you implement hotspots policing, you will likely see small or moderate declines in violence, not the same effect sizes that we saw in focused deterrence. In another major strategy, problem-oriented policing, has been similarly proven effective, but with similarly small effect sizes. And so what I want to suggest here is that you can't be satisfied with the average hotspots or problem-oriented policing strategy. And so my suggestion here is that we need to combine these strategies. It's not enough to put cops on dots. And in fact, what we've seen in the United States is that some forms of hotspots policing, when we enact zero tolerance approaches, can actually be counterproductive. And everybody is familiar with the history of New York City with stop and frisk, that similar mistakes have been made elsewhere in the country. So when we are policing these high crime locations, it's not enough simply to be in the right place. We also have to improve our effectiveness by increasing our focus, by using good intelligence and data, our balance, understanding that we can't simply use aggressive stops and searches to deter crime, and fairness. Even when you are dealing with the highest risk places and the highest risk and the highest risk people, you must be fair and respectful. And in fact, this is something that's not often well understood, but the criminal community, the community of these individuals at the highest risk for violence, it matters what they think about law enforcement, because ultimately, some of these individuals are going to be held accountable by the law and removed from society. But you need some of these people to voluntarily desist from criminal and violent behavior. That won't happen if they don't believe that the system is fair and will give them a fair opportunity to change. We also need to use behavior-based approaches. And here in the United States, there are many broad-based efforts and discussions about how to remove guns and gangs and drugs from society. But unfortunately, when we're dealing specifically with urban violence, those broad-based efforts have not been successful for the most part. So I want to talk about a different way of looking at this. To enhance the effectiveness of these strategies, you have to reframe knives and guns and gangs and these other things, not as objects, but as behaviors, so that you can link them to this people and place-based analysis. So don't think of knives and guns. Think of illegal knife and gun carrying, the behavior. Don't think of gangs, but think of gang banging. Don't think of drugs, but instead of violent drug dealing. And then you can tie all these things to the highest risk people and places. So your goal then is not to focus on these things generally, but among the highest risk people and places, we have to eliminate knife and gun carrying, we have to eliminate group conflict, and we have to eliminate drug conflict. And as you can see, all of these, you know, chronic, complicated, seemingly intractable issues start to be broken down into solvable problems. So what's the prognosis? If we properly diagnose and treat violence, what can we expect? First of all, in order to do this successfully, you're gonna need multiple strategies operating at the same time to build a cumulative impact. As I said, if you're operating, if you're using hotspots, problem-oriented policing, you're likely to see some anti-violence effect, but not sufficient. And so you're gonna need other strategies to supplement that effect. So you need to identify, implement, and coordinate a portfolio of strategies that taken together are focused, balanced, and fair. I've created a framework here. It's quite simple, and it's it blends sort of frameworks from both public safety and public health. And you can see the simple framework here. And you can see how it's populated with the programs that I describe in my book. So for instance, looking at the top row, in terms of people-based prevention, you can see CBT or cognitive-based therapy, home visiting and parent training to work on prevention. Then you can use cognitive behavioral therapy, focused deterrence and street outreach for intervention. And ultimately, use for enforcement, you can improve homicide clearance rates and shooting clearance rates, as well as focused deterrence. And then you can look at the place-based row, the behavior-based row, and so on and so forth. And so I'm not suggesting that every city needs to do every one of these strategies, but I am suggesting that they need to do more than one. So these strategies taken together don't need new laws, as you heard before. They don't need big budgets. They don't even depend on massive institutional reforms. They can be done right now. And here in the United States, for an additional $30,000 in funding per homicide, you can put this approach into place and expect a reduction in homicide of about 10% each year for 8 years. Now, that might not sound like much, but over 8 years, that's an over 50% reduction in homicide. And if we did this across this nation's 40 most violent cities, we would save over 12,000 lives and save over $120 billion. So just think about that for a moment. Now, these strategies are needed now more than ever. Unfortunately, looking at crime rates in the United States in 2020, we saw a massive spike in homicide rates, 30% higher than the previous year. And that's a historic increase representing more than 1,200 deaths in the sample of 34 cities that Rick Rosenfeld and I looked at in January of this year. I'm a senior fellow at the Council on Criminal Justice and the director of the National Commission on COVID-19 and Crime. And through that commission effort, we've commissioned a number of studies in this area. I urge you to look at them. These increases in homicide and violence are deeply troubling, but we should be mindful that absolute rates of violence are still well below their historical highs that they were in the early 90s. Now, property and drug crime rates did the opposite. They actually plunged dramatically, with the exception of motor vehicle theft, in 2020. This is not just an issue in the United States. I'm well aware of the alarming increases in knife crime in the UK. And we did see, after a temporary drop in certain types of crime and violence globally, caused most likely by the lockdown and stay-at-home orders, that we're seeing a resurgence in various forms of crime and violence since that time. So here's just some data. This is 3 years of homicide data in a sample of 34 cities that Rick Rosenfeld and I looked at. And as you can see, in 2020, the year starts out bad and then gets significantly worse. You see that red line is a structural break to indicate a statistically significant jump in violence. And you can see that it occurs in late May, early June, almost exactly around the time of the verdict, not of the verdict, but of the horrible murder of George Floyd by a police officer in Minneapolis. And then crime spikes during the summer and then declines significantly, but remains above the three-year averages. And this is, we believe this will likely be, when the final numbers are in, the largest single year increase in homicide ever recorded since we've had modern crime statistics for about the last 50 years. It wasn't just one city. As you can see here, in our sample of 34 cities, there's only four or five in which they did not experience some form of increase in homicide. And what that tells you is that what's happening in the United States is not a localized issue, it's a national issue. So what do we believe happened? Rick and I looked carefully at this. And we believe that the pandemic disproportionately affected vulnerable populations. Those who were at the highest risk for violence were also at the highest risk for COVID-19. And so these individuals were already disadvantaged, already disenfranchised, already alienated, were placed under additional stress. And it wasn't just those individuals, it was also institutions, law enforcement, EMS, hospitals, all were placed under tremendous pressure. And also all of the non-enforcement apparatuses that were working to reduce violence, community-based efforts, service providers and others, all were placed under tremendous strain, both operationally and financially, during the pandemic. And in fact, what we've seen, and as if one of the things that you can take from this talk, is that successful violence reduction depends on proactively outreaching to at-risk people and places. And we're not doing enough of that here in the United States, but we are doing some of that. And what we found is that all of that proactive outreach, whether it was done by law enforcement or others, stopped suddenly with the pandemic. And what we see is that as the while there might have been a brief suppressive effect of the state of the lockdown, we see violence spiraling out of control after that. And in fact, the biggest spike in violence happened immediately, as I said, after the death of George Floyd. So once again, here in the United States, we are dealing with the consequences of police violence. This follows a pattern, as we saw a few years ago after Michael Brown was killed in Ferguson, Missouri. Police violence triggers protests that is ultimately followed by spikes in violence. Why does this happen? Well, again, police violence produces cynicism. And as we've discussed, cynicism reduces cooperation with police. Less reporting, fewer witnesses, and that reduced cooperation means that more disputes will turn violent and more violent disputes will turn deadly. You know, what about this so-called Ferguson effect or a depolicing effect? Did, in response to protests and criticism, did police change their policies and tactics, resulting in crime increases? There is strong evidence that in certain cities, post-Ferguson, like Baltimore, Chicago, and St. Louis, where there were local incidents triggering this, there was a change in police behavior. Police conducted less discretionary law enforcement activity that was closely followed by increases in violence. We see some evidence of a similar effect post-Floyd. And so I think it's fair to say that it appears likely that abrupt, unplanned pullbacks in police activity will lead to increased violence. But I want to make an important caveat here. That doesn't tell us that more policing is necessarily better policing. And in fact, most of what we know is that the type of policing matters more than the amount of policing, generally speaking. So the fact that this depolicing effect is an actual phenomenon does not mean that we should simply respond to these issues with more police and more aggressive policing. What it means is that when you suddenly, without warning, change your tactics and don't have an alternative in place, that you will see violence rise. But this broader content conversation about police legitimacy, about the right amount of policing and the right type of policing is important and should continue. We know that unwarranted police force, and especially deadly force, it increases violence and simultaneously cripples law enforcement's ability to respond. So what can we do about it? What does the evidence say? Procedural justice policies that train police in procedural justice principles are quite promising, but we still need more evidence. De-escalation training, which I think we are learning a lot from our colleagues in the UK and elsewhere, is very promising, but needs more study. Body-worn cameras are not consistently producing their intended effects. This has been well studied by Cynthia Lum and others, although I think a lot of the implementation matters significantly in this area. And a very popular form of training here in the United States, implicit bias training, has little if no evidence supporting it whatsoever. Where I work, the Council on Criminal Justice has established a separate task force on policing. I urge you to visit the website for the task force on policing. There are some excellent, excellent products in this area that are looking at the evidence, but then synthesizing that evidence with a lot of the best thinking of practitioners and others. So what are my takeaways here for you, for this audience? And I'm assuming that this audience is mostly law enforcement. So my first takeaway is you need to stay focused. You need to focus on the worst crimes committed by the most dangerous people in the most dangerous places. Put first things first. So that's the first principle. The second principle is you should not go it alone. You need help. You need service providers, community members, researchers, and others working in partnership with you. You alone are not the solution to crime and violence. You are an important piece of the puzzle, but you need to have partners working alongside you. You must also be trusted. Without legitimacy, you will not make sustained progress on crime and violence. As the protest chant goes, no justice, no peace. Like doctors, law enforcement should strive to first do no harm. We need to make unlawful excessive force a thing of the past, and we need to limit our most aggressive law enforcement measures only to the most serious offenses. One of the things that we're seeing here in the United States again and again with these controversial and unwarranted uses of force is that they're often triggered by surprisingly minor offenses. And so we need to look carefully at that issue. And lastly, we need to police protest properly. Ed McGuire is an excellent resource in this area, and he argues that in order to police protest properly, We need to educate ourselves about the protesters and their goals. We need to facilitate their lawful exercise of their free speech rights. We need to communicate proactively with them. And we need to differentiate peaceful protesters from violent protesters and not treat them all the same way. Those are my takeaways. That's my time. I hope you enjoyed the presentation, and I look forward to your questions.
Sasha, you're muted.
Doesn't that always happen on Teams? Thank you very much, Tom, for that absolutely critical piece of work. It's really great to hear from you. We only have to look at our TV screens, I think, on a daily basis to see some of the challenges that we have in terms of policing in a COVID environment. And it's really good that you've included that in your presentation here today and your findings around that. I think, Suzanne, if we can add the task force on policing into the sidebar so some people are able to access that, that would be fabulous. And I think in terms of your takeaways, you know, I think we fully recognise in policing that we can't do that in isolation. We can't do this in isolation. We absolutely need our partners alongside us with it, and the importance of legitimacy. And I think we do have some legitimacy challenges now, and we do with some of the legislation that that we have in place, and the importance of making sure that we police legitimacy, and particularly that the learning around protests across the length and breadth, I think, of the world is really, really important at this time when we are anticipating that we would see more protests. So I think that's brilliant. In terms of questions, so if I can opening up to questions, we've got one from Abigail. She's wondering if you could talk a bit about how practitioners should evaluate or demonstrate impact of people place behavior based approaches. Tom.
Sure. This is a great question. And, you know, there's a debate in the field about what's the proper way to evaluate. And, you know, and I am a pragmatist. I sort of avoid the extremes. I'm not a randomista that thinks that every single strategy needs to be evaluated with an RCT, but I do believe that ultimately the more rigorous methods are the more convincing ones. And so what I would say is it really depends on the size of the intervention. If you're starting a strategy, a small pilot, I suggest a less costly, less formal form of evaluation. You know, just get some pre-post data to sort of see whether you're on the right track. But as you start to expand and as you start to take up more resources, you need to up the quality of your intervention. And so ultimately, you're going to need a more rigorous form of evaluation. And you're going to need an evaluation that creates causal evidence, an evidence that creates an if-then relationship between your intervention and the outcome. But what I would say is it's okay to start informal, and but you have to end more formal and more rigorous.
Okay. So Jose says, I believe there's a training issue related to those cases of misuse of force.
I certainly agree with Jose. And Jose, if I see from your picture, it looks like you're wearing a gi there. I too train Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu. I recommend it to anyone in the audience who's interested in fitness and surprisingly nonviolent ways of controlling people. I wish more people in law enforcement trained in Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu. Let me say something about training based on some of the findings of the task force and the findings more broadly. I think we really misunderstand the fundamental purpose of training. Training is not an end in and of itself. It's a means to an end. And so I believe that trainings that are unaccompanied by fundamental changes in policy are generally ineffective. And so It's one thing to train people in de-escalation tactics or procedural justice or all other types of important strategies. But if the command structure, if the policy manual, if the patrol guidance has not changed to say you must do these things, then that training is going to have a temporary effect at best. Ultimately, the organization has to change its policies and procedures and then train around that. Otherwise, training is just training.
Okay. I like the point, Thomas, that you made when you were doing your TED Talks around bridging the gap between research and practice. How do we get to speak the same language? How do we make that easy to do?
Well, I think that someone has to put in the hard work of translating rigorous research findings into plain English. It doesn't have to be the same person who created those findings, but there has to be a translation process. And so I believe that, you know, if you want any piece of research to be well-read and well-understood by the field, you know, you need to translate it into a plain English summary that's short and accessible. And so we need people who understand the research, but also understand the field, to be providing a translation or an ambassador function. And, you know, that's one of the things I love about the Society of Evidence-Based Policing, is many of you out there are performing precisely this function. And so it's not enough, as the question suggests, to simply produce this evidence. This evidence then needs to be communicated carefully to the field.
And I guess that probably takes me on to another question, because you've had some key leadership roles in some, you know, high profile departments. And you've done this meta review, you've done extensive semi-structured interviews, and you've produced this research, you've produced this book. I guess it's the so what. So is this being translated into policy, or how are you seeing it translated into policy?
Yeah, so, you know, I think for those of us who have been involved in policymaking for a long time, or in, you know, either in law enforcement or outside of law enforcement, you know, we see incremental progress. We see the field slowly maturing, slowly responding. I think the issue is that incremental progress enough? Are we moving fast enough? I think that it's, I think any reasonable person looking at the data, looking at the evidence would say, in terms of measuredness of both fairness and effectiveness, law enforcement in the United States, in the UK, and in many places is progressing. But is it meeting the needs of and the expectations of the populace? In many cases, clearly not. And that's something that we have to reckon with. And ultimately, we do not create, I'm a former prosecutor, a former member of law enforcement. We do not set the expectations for what we do. We are public servants. And so we have to meet the expectations of the public. And so that's something we have to strive to do.
Okay. I think so. Jose, on one hand, police officers are not being prepared during initial training to react to every suspect's acts.
Yes, I think that I also think that, you know, the better prepared officers are to deal with non-compliant individuals and individuals who may resist them, actually, the less likely they are to use aggressive force measures. And so I think that that's an important thing. And in fact, you know, I think that one of the key issues in the United States and one of the reasons we're plagued by so many of these issues is that we do not have a philosophy of de-escalation like you do in some parts of the UK and other places. It is widely accepted in the United States as sort of the convention that in order for police to secure themselves, the scene, people at the scene, they have to establish immediate control. And in order, and they are, and they should use whatever force they need to establish that immediate control. And that is why, in so many instances, unfortunately, you see rates of force spiraling quickly in the United States, because police are not trained to temporarily retreat in the United States. That's not an acceptable practice in many areas. Now, we are trying to change this now, but it is in a large country. It's a decentralized system, over 18,000 autonomous law enforcement organizations. And so it will take time. We have to push hard, because I think proper training and proper change in policies again and de-escalation is going to be critical here in the United States.
Okay. We've got a question from Wendy. What is the place for gender and economic considerations within your framework?
Well, this is a good question. Urban violence is overwhelmingly perpetrated by men. Approximately 90% of perpetrators are men, and the vast majority of victims are men. And it's important to understand that ultimately both the perpetrators and the victims of this type of violence are men. And so our focus is properly on men in this context. However, there are other forms of violence, domestic violence, gender-based violence, relationship-based violence, that are inherently involving both genders or non-binary people as well. I don't mean to leave them out here. And there is a relationship between various forms of violence. And roughly speaking, we see evidence that exposure to family violence, domestic violence, gender-based violence early in life can lead to higher likelihoods of perpetrating other forms of violence later in life. And so we need to work on all of these things simultaneously. But it's important to understand that we need specific strategies for specific types of violence. My book hopefully provides some effective strategies for reducing urban violence specifically. We need another book or books like this to address domestic violence. Then we need another book to address school violence. Then we need another book to address organized criminal violence.
And I think that is a really good point, because one of the things I wrote down when you were speaking was you talked about poor children performing better if not exposed to violence. And I guess and I was thinking, well, is that the same for children from all backgrounds if they are exposed to violence? But as you rightly point out, it's a separate topic area. But it does beg the question that you're not just looking at future perpetrators, but actually, if you were talking about domestic abuse, does it lower their life expectancies and life chances, not just for them to be a perpetrator, but actually to get on in life? So it'd be really interesting for that kind of study.
Sasha, you raise a great point. And, you know, the literature here is from the adverse child experience area, the ACE studies. And one of the things that we see is that most people are quite resilient to one incident or one type of trauma. So people who were neglected by a parent early in life can often be resilient and overcome that without major effects. But what we see is when you have polyvictimization, people who are exposed to both emotional, physical, and sexual abuse, that you see the chemical pathways in the brain start to change. And you see these, you see the risky behaviors, you see the long-term health outcomes. And so yes, someone from a privileged background can experience a form of trauma and they can be resilient to that. But the more disadvantaged you are, the more you are among the poor and powerless, the more likely you are to suffer from multiple forms of trauma or abuse and neglect all at the same time. And that is where you see the most damaging physical changes in the brain.
That is huge thank you, Thomas, for your input today. It's been brilliant. It's very thought-provoking. Thank you for people turning up and participating today. Can I just remind people that we've got another four seminars within the series to look forward to, so I hope to see you out there. As I say, thank you to everyone, and please enjoy the rest of your afternoon. I hope it's certainly put questions in all of your minds. Thank you.
Thank you.